This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
Well, here we are ready to go back into the book of Genesis. We're going to start out tonight with a little quick scan of antediluvian history. Ante means before the deluge, before the flood. And then we want to go ahead and talk about the Genesis flood, one of the most challenging and stumbling passages in the Bible. Hope we can get some answers tonight that will satisfy you. In Genesis chapter 4, after the murder of Abel, which we studied last week, Cain, the firstborn human, son of Adam and Eve, went out from the presence of the Lord, it says in verse 16. And so this is kind of a poignant comment, suggestive of Cain's attitude throughout, which has been one of rebellion and a kind of self-centered rage against God. When he went out, he formed a line, and I think as far as Cain's wife, I think we can assume from chapter 5, verse 4, that Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters, that it must have been one of his relatives. The time spans are rather long here, and we'll speak about that later. In the line of Cain, which developed, here in chapter 4, we see a series of specific references. First of all, his son, he named Enoch. Enoch built a city, and he named the city Enoch. This is the first city that we have recorded in the Bible. It's certainly suggestive of a higher level of civilization. He names it after himself, so maybe there's a little bit of the ego worked in there too. Verse 19, we notice that Lamech, a couple of guys down the line, took two wives, and this is the first recorded incident of polygamy, which of course departs from the ideal that is clearly enunciated in chapter 2 of Genesis, verse 26, where he talks about that God's ideal is that the two should become one. Here we have the three becoming one. And polygamy became an institution which was accepted in the Old Testament more as a matter of concession, not as an ideal. In verse 20, his son, Jabal, is the father of those who have livestock and live in tents. So this may be signaling some sort of advancement in the whole field of herdiculture. In 21, his brother was Jubal, so it's Jabal and Jubal. And they don't get too original with these names. They stick pretty close to home. He is the father of those who play the lyre and the harp. And so apparently music and the arts were flourishing in this line as well. Then you have Tubal-Cain, who it says was the father of those who forge implements of bronze and iron. Probably meteoric iron at this time in history, very ancient period. That was the only kind of iron they knew how to make then, long before the Iron Age. I think what he's signaling here is here's an advancement in technology. Metallurgy is the underlayment of much advancement in human culture. Then he goes back to Lamech again and tells a little anecdote about him. We read in verse 23 that Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech is avenged seventy-sevenfold. And so here you get kind of a little slice of life and a little feeling for all of the swagger and the arrogance and the brutality that was characterizing the ethos of this whole line that was developing. So there's terrific advancement suggested here, and they were making rapid progress forward on the material and the cultural level, but on the spiritual level, you see the opposite. You see a deterioration into a more savage mentality. Now, over against that, we have then in chapter 5 the generations of Seth, who, after Abel died, Seth was born, and God said that he would be like a replacement to Eve for Seth, who was lost. The line of Seth is given in substantially more detail than the line of Cain, but interestingly, they don't have anything to show for what they did like the other line does. They're quite unremarkable. There's only two comments included. One is in chapter 4, verse 26, where it says, "At the time of Enosh, then men began to call upon the name of the Lord." And again later, then in 5, verse 22, "Then Enoch walked with God and was no more." That's about all they have to say in this line. And of course, it's the line of Seth in which Noah is born. This line seems to have taken an interest in the things of God. Maybe they didn't accomplish as much as the other guys. And this becomes sort of a theme, I think. We'll just keep an eye on this in the book of Genesis, the formation of two humanities, two different attitudes toward life. The one is rich in materialistic, cultural, and technological progress, progress on every axis. And the other is, materially speaking, unremarkable. We'll see as we get into the line of Terah and Abraham and all of these. They weren't poor men, but as it points out in the book of Hebrews, Abraham never did own a single square foot of ground in all of Israel, and he had to buy a plot to bury his wife in from someone. So these guys really weren't weighing in there with very much punch in terms of the world system and building the glory of human civilization. But we can still raise the question, although they're unremarkable on the material level, they do have an impact spiritually, which of course, here we are sitting here tonight and reading the material that they have brought down to us, right? We're here tonight following one who comes from the line of Seth, Jesus Christ, and we're pondering some of the deep things that this line has brought forward. On the other side, how many of us have ever spent a vacation in the city of Enoch or ever even visited the land of Nod? Wherever these things are, they're long lost. We don't even know where these things are anymore. And so what must have seemed very important and impressive at the time, looking at it from our perspective today, has lost all importance and is frankly completely unimportant. Whereas what the other line was doing when it came to walking with the Lord, that's something that seems to have a more enduring importance and something that we're still pondering and trying to move deeper into today. I think there's a lot to think about here. It's the temporal versus the eternal value system. That's what's contrasted in these two lines. Well, let's keep moving because we're going to cover from chapter 4 through 8 tonight, so we can't really slow down much. We want to talk about the deluge, the great flood in Genesis. I would consider this a problematic stumbling passage. People in interviews and surveys about why people don't believe the Bible cite this passage second only to the creation narrative as the reason why they can't accept that the Bible can be squared with modern science. I know that feeling because when I became a Christian, I looked at this passage and saw a pretty serious problem here. For my faith, I really had to wonder, you know, do I have to accept this, or is this possibly maybe a religious myth or what? I mean, how much do we have to believe here? Look at the problems. I'll list the problems in this for you, and we'll just try to solve them accordingly. First, we've got the problem in chapter 6 of occult sexuality, one of the most bizarre passages in the Bible. Next, we have the great ages for the people living to be hundreds of years old. We have a question to be posed about the dimensions of the ark. Could there really be such a thing? And if there were, could it do what they said it did? Or is this a mythological object that's being described here? Then there is the notion of a universal flood and the very severe problems that come up critically in connection with believing in such a thing as a world flood. not only the fact that water's covering the earth is a problem, but also the reason for the water covering the earth, which was the virtual destruction of the human race, raises moral questions that I think are pretty profound. And of course, what application does it have for today? Is there any point to it? That's another problem still. So we have a lot of work to do in understanding this account. Let's start reading in chapter 6, verse 1 through 4. It says, "When men began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose." They went into them, married. I think that's NIV. Yeah, they took wives. Okay, so they did marry them. "Then the Lord said, My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown." Well, okay, what is it? What are we reading here? We're reading about occult sexuality. Sexual relations between spirit beings and humans. Kind of the Rosemary's Baby motif. That's what this is talking about. The sons of God in this record are fallen angels. According to Jude, verse 6, and 2 Peter 2, verse 4, these were both angels who, it says, did not keep their proper abode, but sought after strange flesh. And in both cases, it also records that they were confined to the pit by God because of this activity. In reflecting on this, we can note a couple of things. For one thing, this kind of thing of sexual union between a human, usually woman, and some sort of a demon, a very common theme in occult and religious literature. The incubi-succubi phenomena. Typically, in most lore, the one woman incubates the seed of the devil, and the other is the succubi. She nurses them. We're familiar with many ancient legends and lore about godmen, those who were spawned by a part human and part divine ancestry. Very common. Everybody knows the story of Hercules. That was an example. He had a god for a father and a woman for a mother. And there are hundreds, even thousands of different accounts along these lines in ancient literature, one of which is before us now in Genesis chapter 6. Apparently, this did happen, if we're to believe the Bible. It may well be that the types of creatures that did this are not around anymore. You know, if you study angels in the Bible, they're not all the same. There are different types of beings that are not human, but which are spiritual beings whom God has created. We're not the only spiritual beings in the universe. There are others. And of course, in the case of most angels, we're talking about a being that is spiritual but not physical. But it may be that some creatures might be physical and spiritual, or at least able to, nearer to that divide, whatever it might be. There was something about this particular activity that was menacing enough that God confined these beings to the pit and locked them up. So I don't think it's something that's going on today. It's interesting when you consider probably the only person really who was truly God and man was Jesus Christ. And if you study occult literature and if you study the Bible too in the field of the occult, the desire to imitate and mimic that which God does and to counterfeit it is very great. And this may account for why in occult literature there's such a fascination with the desire to blend spiritual and human in an offspring. It's because it's imitating and counterfeiting what God actually did. Some of these unions were apparently successful. It says that the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and the Nephilim were great ones. The name comes from a stem, that means to fall upon a prey. These were hunters, these were warrior types, and the implication of Nephilim is normally also that they're oversized, big. Later in the Old Testament, Goliath is called a Nephilim. And when we saw in Numbers, the children of Israel were afraid of the sons of Anak, they called them Nephilim. They were giants. They seemed like giants. There were some oversized people in this part of the world. We gather from some of the excavations that have found enormous bedsteads that look like they may have been inhabited by some very large fellers. It sort of makes you wonder. I don't know really what to think about it. Apparently it was something that was happening. It was something very menacing, very dangerous to the human race, and it was something which God put an end to. Could it be that some of these ancient legends and the lore are perhaps exaggerated to one extent or another, but might have kernels of original truth in them, that some of the ancients essentially in their mythology remembered some of these Nephilim, these great ones, men of renown, as it calls them, and worshiped them as though they were gods? I think it's possible. I think it's possible. Certainly, it's awfully strange and nothing that we have ever seen or probably ever will see or be able to confirm with our own senses. I think it's cited here not because this is the only problem or even the greatest problem that was going on, but because it was typical of the moral disintegration within the human race at that time. Look at verse 5, where it says, "Then the Lord saw that the intent of man was only evil continually. His heart was filled with violence." We read in verse 11 and 12, "Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, and all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth." So what we have described here is a culture that is virtually obsessed with evil, is experiencing a thirst for evil. All of their intentions are violence and evil continually. This is as though a cancer had taken over the human race, and we read that God felt sorrow. In verse 6, "The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he grieved in his heart." Not sorry in our sense of the word, where he was surprised and didn't realize that this would happen, because an omniscient God, of course, wouldn't be that way. He would have known this was coming. But he was sorry in the sense that it says, that he grieved in his heart, that he felt a sorrow. And our God is one who has feelings. And he felt terrific sorrow over this. And of course, he felt for the few remaining believers on earth who were on the verge of practically just being eradicated. And so he made the decision to conduct radical surgery. And he says to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence," in verse 13. And so he has decided to judge and destroy the human race. Well, we'll talk about the issue of judgment in a minute. This then brings up the next problem, which is, as we read on in chapter 6, God tells Noah, who found favor in his sight, a married man with three sons and three daughters, that he and his family would be preserved from this holocaust, this flood. And he says in verse 14, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood." And it's supposed to have rooms covered inside and out with pitch and so on. Its length, 300 cubits, breadth is 50 cubits, and its height is 30 cubits. A window, which is like a gallery all the way around the edge, and then a first, second, and third decks inside. "And behold, I'm going to bring a flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh which has the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that's on the earth shall perish." The world flood. Now, when we come to a universal flood, we raise a new set of problems. First of all, no, I don't think we can say that this is a religious myth, not without completely gutting the Bible of all value and just basically relegating it to the ash can of history. If we take the Bible or the teachings of Jesus Christ seriously at all, you should be aware that Jesus believed this was a historical event. And he said in Matthew chapter 24, verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man returns. And so another piece of biblical material that people find hard to believe, the return of Christ, is tied directly to the days of Noah. And I suppose if one is mythical, the other one could just as well be as also. There is some evidence of a flood. It's a mixed picture, but it does appear that there have been some amazingly large floods in the history of the world. We don't find a worldwide flood strata in the sedimentary rock layers. You know, at 6 foot, here's where we can point, this was the flood event here. Neither would we expect to see anything like that, since this entire event was nothing but a blink of an eye in geological terms. The whole thing took less than a year. It only took half a year to happen. And that would not create very much in terms of a geological record whatsoever. So I don't think that Christian scientists that I have studied have not felt surprised by this at all. There are some geological problems with it, though, which we'll touch on. One piece of evidence that seems to suggest the possibility of large-scale flooding are the ossiferous fissures which have been discovered in numerous places throughout the world. There are several dozen of these fissures which are actually cracks in the surface of the earth that have been filled with animals' bones. The interesting thing about them is that in some of these fissures there are hundreds and even thousands of different species of animal life where their bones have been left in these fissures. And the bones are separated from the matching bones within the fissures. So in other words, an individual animal will be spread out and his bones can be identified in different places, which suggests that the animals were dead long before settling into this fissure, that they didn't die by falling into the fissure, but were first killed, then fell into the fissure. That no river or stream geology is associated with the ossiferous fissures, which is important because obviously, like if you go to Dinosaur National Monument out in the western U.S., they find a lot of dinosaur bones in this one area, but it's well known that that was in a large bend of an ancient river. And that's the reason that the animal bodies were washing down and being covered with silt, which later solidified and fossilized their bones. And so you would expect to find a lot of bones concentrated into an area like that. So too, if it was like a tar pit, you would expect to see a lot of bones there. But if it's just a crack in the ground with no stream geology associated with it, it's hard to figure why that would fill up with bones. It doesn't happen in other cracks that are around, just in some of these certain ancient group of ossiferous fissures. And finally, the bones are cast in a calcium deposit, which suggests that they were born there by water. And calcium is only formed when water deposits calcium there. So, for a number of reasons, these ossiferous fissures suggest large-scale flooding that killed large numbers of different types of animals. And then as the water drained away, the bones tended to settle in fissures and cracks and were calcified there. Well, there's evidence like frozen mastodons that makes scientists wonder. The interesting thing about these, for instance, have been found in northern Siberia and even north of Siberia in the islands above Siberia, well above the Arctic Circle, usually completely frozen and buried in deep pack ice, often miles deep. They have been frozen intact, some with undigested food in their stomachs or even in their mouth. which suggests that these were not the Arctic strain of mammoths that starved to death up there, but that they were killed suddenly by a catastrophe of some sort. And of course, the locations that they're found in, they're far away from the range, a suitable range, where they would be able to get that sort of food in, in an Arctic area. Now or at any reasonable time relative to where they were frozen. That's why even secular thinkers have suggested that probably they were born there again by water. And that's the most reasonable suggestion. Some scientists simply call it an anomaly and have reached no conclusion, which is perfectly reasonable in science. If we don't know why they're there, we don't have to reach a conclusion. We can simply say, we'll figure that out when we get more evidence. For now, we don't know why the mammoths are there. But on the other hand, maybe we do know why they were there. And this is what I'm suggesting. Well, people have said, we think we found pieces of the Ark itself on Mount Ararat, and there have been several expeditions that have gone there to get it. They brought back some planking. One form of dating they used dated the hand-hewn planking that was taken off of a glacier above the tree line on Mount Ararat at 6,000 years old, but with an error factor of plus or minus 6,000 years. That's the figure that's recorded in the books that have been written on this subject. Carbon-14 dating said 1,700 years plus or minus 100 years. That's probably more. And by the way, that agrees with the other form of dating at 6,000 plus or minus 6,000 years. So I think that the correct date for them is actually within the Christian era. I don't think that this is the Ark. Some have suggested it might be a Byzantine monastery that was built, or at least attempted to be built, commemorating probably Noah's Ark, because this was Mount Ararat, a mountain of 17,000 feet tall. It's a very tall mountain. And obviously the wood was hand-hewn, if you've seen pictures of it. And of course, there's no wood growing above the tree line there anyway. So it was definitely taken there by people. But even if it were the Ark, I doubt seriously, I'm sure that it would be very hard to demonstrate that conclusively. I don't put any personal stock in this. On the other hand, when we turn to some of the sociological evidence for a world flood, I think it's really interesting. The Babylonians, the Sumerians, and the Assyrians all have a story of a world flood and a hero who was saved in the flood that's very similar to the Old Testament. So much so that liberal scholars have argued that the Old Testament got its story of the world flood probably from the Babylonians, is the most likely source, they say. Alexander Heidel, I think, has refuted this decisively in his Gilgamesh Epic and Old Testament Parallels, available at the Study Center if you're into that kind of reading. He's got it there in translation. If you'd like to read the Gilgamesh Epic, which you may have heard in your Bible is Lit course, that's what the Bible's based on, and so on and so forth, I don't think so. Read it for yourself. There's very, very little actual similarity there, only the most superficial type of similarity. And Heidel is a world-class scholar and points this out. He's not, by the way, any kind of a born-again Christian, so it's objective. These could be borrowing from one another, and probably did borrow from one another. That's certainly what scholars believe. But what are we going to say, then, about the Egyptians, who also had a flood story, as recorded in Plato's Pseudomenetho? The Greeks had their flood story as well, in Deucalion and Phaera. And the Arameans had a flood story. They're all very similar to the Old Testament as well. And now we've moved out another ring further away from that area of the world. Then what about the Hindus? They have Manu, who, with his wife and three sons and three daughters, escaped a world flood that killed everyone else, and they alone escaped on a raft. Chinese talk about Fa He, who, with his three sons and three daughters and wife, escaped the world flood in a canoe. The Hawaiians have a flood story as well. Their hero is named Nu'u. The Mexican Indians have one, and their hero is called Tepzi. And the Algonquins have Manabozho. The Aborigines of the Andaman Islands and the Bay of Bengal, all of these up to this point have said there was a world flood and a man with some close relatives, often wife with three sons and three daughters, and at other times different combinations, escaped in a bark, a raft, a canoe, or what have you, from the flood which was brought on by the wrath of God. Now we have related stories that are slightly different, like these Aborigines, the Andaman Islands. They taught that a tall mountain is what saved the man and his family, and they got up to the summit of a tall mountain and escaped the flood that way. Agreeing with them are the Batraks of Sumatra, the Kurenai, the Fiji Islanders, and the Polynesians and the Micronesians. The tribesmen at Lake Kudai in the Sudan have an identical story, as do some of the tribesmen in the New Guineas and the New Zealanders. The tribesmen of the New Hebrides and the Celts of Wales also have a similar flood narrative in their religious lore, as do the Hottentots. All of these tell a story about how in ancient times a family was saved from a world flood. And we're citing examples from all over the globe here. It's really kind of a remarkable thing. 270 distinct world flood traditions exist worldwide that scientists have identified, and that number continues to grow as we study the lore of tribal peoples. There's very few tribal peoples that don't have a world flood story. We see that these people are isolated from one another, they're remote. There's really no way that they can share and pass this information between them. That's unrealistic. Perhaps what we're dealing with here is some sort of a universal memory. One plausible explanation would be that there really was a flood, that a human family was saved, and that that memory, distorted more or less, depending, has been passed down through the centuries. Compare this body of tradition to that involved with the lost civilization of Atlantis. This isn't quite as popular as it was 10 or 15 years ago. Pretty much, you know, it was like the hip thing to believe in Atlantis and pyramid power and all this kind of stuff. How many accounts do you suppose there were of the city of Atlantis? Will Durant, very skeptical historical scholar, author of a 15-volume history of civilization, a man so skeptical that he wondered whether Jesus Christ even existed, a guy who is not easy to convince about much of anything in the ancient world, of Atlantis, for the evidence for that, he says, it's altogether too weighty to ignore. How much evidence is this that's too weighty to ignore? Actually, there's a total of three accounts of Atlantis that exist, and one of those, scholars including Durant, believe is directly cited from the other, so there's really only two. And that he considers too weighty to ignore. Well, that gives you a little perspective of what we're dealing with when it comes to flood narratives. The world flood is 100 times over more common in ancient lore than is Atlantis, and I think that it's 100 times more compelling for that reason. Some sort of flood, yes. Let's talk about the dimensions of the ark. Is this feasible? If we take cubits to be the conservative size of the 18-inch range, they could be either 18 or 24 inches, anything in between there. A cubit was originally the distance between your elbow and the tip of your finger, but in different cultures they have different lengths, so it's hard to say. Certainly we're dealing with at least 500 feet long, 80 feet wide, and 50 feet tall. It's an ocean-going barge. It has three floors in it, and it's shaped like a big casket or box. That's what the word ark means, is a box or a casket. That's not the bathtub thing that you see in the Sunday school books. that's the way boats looked, you know, the little sailing boats that were used in the Mediterranean. But this was an ark, was probably just a great big box. We need to remember that God told him to take some of each kind of animal, not every species, so there wouldn't be millions of species that he would need to bring on, but he would need to bring on some of each kind, which may be a much broader description. And of course, if you believe in the local flood, in context, it would be some of each kind in that area or region. Of course, when we think of animals going on the ark, not every animal's an elephant, right, or a giraffe. Most animals are a lot smaller than that, and as a matter of fact, can have their cages stacked and so forth. I would refer you to Gleason Archer's calculations in the Survey of Old Testament Introduction, where he studies this ark with its three floors and shows that there's sufficient square footage there to house the entire San Diego Zoo, 5,000 species, allowing one entire level for nothing but food and fodder, which would be enough to keep them in food for a year. It's a very interesting piece of study he does. What we find is that what's being described here is indeed feasible. But this brings us to yet another question. Is it necessarily a world flood, or could it be like a local flood? That's what some people would say, that actually this flood just covered the region of Mesopotamia, not the whole world. Well, I think you can immediately see what the appeal of that theory would be. The local flood theorists point out that when it says the water covered the whole land, like in 724, it says the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. This word for earth or land is eretz. It doesn't always mean the whole earth. Often, in fact, is used like Eretz Israel is the land of Israel. So earth or land could be, in context, speaking about this land, the water was over the entire land that we're on, that the human community at this early stage was still small enough that it only occupied that area. Universal flood guys would point out, yeah, Eretz can mean just this land, but the other term, under the whole sky, like we see in 7:19, that the water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. That is a little bit more problematic. And we don't have examples that we can point to where the phrase under the whole sky has only referred to a region. The local flood theorists would answer back, you don't have that example unless you're looking at one right here. And they would say, if the context is the whole land, meaning this land, then the whole sky would be the sky over this land. And that would be how they would argue that. The local flood people would point out that the Mesopotamian area, which is this area where these cities and so forth are, and it's where Eden apparently was, the Tigris and Euphrates River are mentioned, that's Iraq, and Iran is there, that this area has only relatively low hills, and it would be those that were covered, not Mount Everest. And so that does alleviate some of the problems involved in this narrative, doesn't it? The universal floods guys would say, if that's the case, how could the ark land on Mount Ararat, which is 17,000 feet tall? If you got up anywhere near the summit on that, you'd already be covering most of the mountains on Earth, because sea level would be 17,000 feet higher than it is today. Well, the local flood guys would say, you know, it would take 8 times as much water as exists on the world now to cover the entire earth, including the mountains, up to a depth of several miles deep, take at least 8 times as much water as we have. So where did it come from, and where did it go to afterwards? This is a good question. There is an answer. It's related to what we read in verse 11 of chapter 7, where it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were opened. It's clear that the water not only came down in rain, but also came up from the deep. And so the suggestion has been that this relates to plate tectonic geology, and that what we have is a situation where the continental plate may have been depressed, perhaps by the direct action of God. So it must have seemed, as this plate was being depressed downward, that the water was rushing up. Although it was the land that was going down. After a period of time, it was thrust outward again and dried off. The water ran off. And so that is at least a physical model that would make possible this kind of thing. They usually also claim that mountains weren't as tall then and a few things like that. I've seen one model where they essentially were able to argue that this could have happened. The problem with it being that this movement of the continental plate would have to be going on, movements which have embraced hundreds of millions of years will have to be compressed into a number of days. And so this would be pretty remarkable if that's what happened. Pretty remarkable indeed. The local flood people say, the term here rendered mountains is in other places is sometimes just used for mound. It could be an Ararat is a region. It could easily be saying that this is some of the foothills in Ararat, not the main peaks themselves. The universal flood people would say, if that's the case, then why save the animal species? I mean, if it's not a world flood, why save them? It's just flooding a certain area. Let the animals repopulate from the surrounding areas. The answer, according to the local flood guys, is that these animals might refer mainly to the livestock and the needed species that the human family would need after the flood in that area. That probably solves some other problems. The world flood people would say, now if Mesopotamia was covered, including even the smaller hills there, to a depth of 22 feet or more, because it talks about a number of cubits over the tops of the highest hills, then you already have several hundred feet of water, which would be enough to flood out much of the world. We're only at 500 feet right here, so we would be in the drink. And much of the world would be flooded anyway, so that you really haven't solved any of the problems by going to a local flood. What are we concluding here? I could go on. This argument has quite a few more points, but I think you get the feeling. One thing that is clear, whichever is true, whether it was a universal flood or a local flood, it was definitely a supernatural event. It was unique in human history and was an unbelievable deluge. Unprecedented. And we're not going to get away from that by any exegetical sleight of hand. And even those who believe that this is a local flood agree that it is obviously a miracle, a supernatural event, not a natural event. And so in the end, I think we reach this conclusion, which is that the credibility of the flood narrative basically depends on whether we spell God with a capital G or a little g. Are we going to say there's a God exists who created the earth and all that's on it, but then come and begin to dictate what he can or cannot do on that earth? I think that would be the problem right there. Once we've admitted the existence of an infinite personal God, we've already crossed the threshold into the supernatural, and at that point, it's clear that basically anything can happen that he wants to happen. There is some evidence that no worldwide flood has occurred within the past 50,000 years, though, and this has to do, for instance, with some of the scoria cones in Europe that have loose scoria that has been undisturbed by water for a period of 50,000 years, and that's a real problem. Those kind of things, there's a number of things like that that just don't seem to fit the universal flood very well. So guys like Hugh Ross believe in the local flood. So does Sailhammer at Trinity Evangelicals. A number of scholars that are conservative, Bible-believing scholars who accept the concept of the local flood. I think it's an exegetical question, and it's not a naturalistic question. It's an exegetical question, and I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions. I don't know. I'm going to wait till I get there and find out. I do think there was a flood, though. I think it was mighty big, maybe universal. It was sure mighty big. It was big enough that it killed the human population that lived at that time. And this brings up another one of our problems, the destruction of the human race. What about that? Here are the points I would make to you on that. First of all, physical death, according to the Bible, is not the worst thing that can happen to someone. As a matter of fact, all people die anyway, often, usually, in some painful way. So shortening the duration of someone's life would not be the ultimate evil that could happen to someone. Undergoing divine judgment in the eternal sense would be a lot worse. Other situations in the Bible, like Sodom and Gomorrah, raise the same question. Is God justified when he judges human sin? This is really what we're wondering here. This flood was not just an accident of nature. It was God saying, I am going to pass a judgment on this civilization that they've gone too far. And they're going to be destroyed because of that. According to the Bible, they were slain by a judging God, a God who judges. Well, that's not what the modern man and woman wants to hear today, do we? We don't want a God who judges. No one's supposed to judge anything. But God really doesn't care what we want to hear or what they wanted to hear either. You know, it's like a talk I had with one gal, and we got to talking about, we had watched a movie about that brought up the subject of hell. And I was like, wouldn't that be a drag to discover that you were in hell? And she was like, well, you know, I don't worry about that because I don't believe in hell. Yeah, well, you know, just because you don't believe in it doesn't mean you're not going to go there. You know, when you come right down to it, it doesn't matter what we think about this. I have a problem with divine judgment. I'll admit that. I can't get next to this concept a whole lot. But I do accept that God is a just God, that he will judge, that he has judged, and will do so again. There will be a judgment day. Yes, we're living in a moral universe. Yes, it does matter. The difference between good and evil matters to God. And he's not going to be welcoming in the tyrants and the destroyers of people and having them into eternal fellowship with himself as though nothing happened. And I'd like you just to think about what that would say about God if he did do something like that. It's not going to happen. The Bible declares God will judge. In this case, a temporal judgment on physical life. But also, the even more serious and awesome judgment of people in their eternal destiny. Whether they get to live with God forever or whether they perish in hell. God's going to do temporal judgment again. We read that when Christ returns, that the world is going to be judged at that point. And many people are going to undergo a fate similar to what happened back at the time of the world flood. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18 to 20 says, For Christ died for sins once and for all, the righteous dying for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. Just like when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this symbolizes baptism that now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a good conscience towards God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In other words, an application, a meaning of the flood is that God judges and also he rescues us from judgment if we're willing to take his rescuing hand. In this case, he says, this is a symbol, the ark. saved these people. They got into the ark and they sailed through the waters of judgment. Not water baptism. He says this symbolizes baptism, but we've shown before baptism doesn't have to mean baptism in water. There's also spiritual baptism where you are put into Christ. That's what's in view here. There were some people that got wet in this story. They're the other ones. Right? The people that got baptized into water, the baptism means to immerse, to put into. The ones that got put into water were the other guys. The ones that were rescued were the ones that were put into the ark. And the ark is a symbol of Jesus Christ. Christ going to the cross and paying the price for our sin there. And we can be identified with him, so that the Bible says we become one with Christ, and therefore we pass out of judgment and into life. Application to today, think about it. In chapter 7, verse 16, he says, on this day they entered the ark, the animals and Noah, and then there was this huge gangplank that he had told them to make one section of the side that folded down, and that was like a ramp in. There was no mechanism for closing the thing or sealing it. It was just built like to sit there. And we read in verse 16 that God closed the door to the ark behind Noah. That would have been a pretty hard decision for Noah to make, seeing the water coming up and thinking we need to close the door. There's people out there and so on and so forth. You know, what's my move here? And he didn't have to make that decision. He went in and it says, God closed the door and sealed it. Now, there may have been some people, and I think maybe that Bill Cosby's routine about Noah and the ark, you know, contains a certain amount of truth. When you imagine a guy building an ocean-going barge far from a large body of water, many of these people, most of them, had probably never seen an ocean. It's fairly desertous up there. And there's a river or two, that's it. And here's this guy building a 500-foot-long barge in his yard. I think they probably did come out with their sack lunches and look and watch him build this thing. And there was a lesson contained here which they didn't get at the time, but we can get it now, which is that, yes, we have freedom of choice. We can decide whether we want to go with God and go his way and accept his means of rescue, or we can decide we're not interested and we're going our own way. We can decide that. And if we decide it one way, we can always change our mind up to a point, up to a point. We have the freedom to choose and to change our mind, but it's a finite freedom. Our freedom to choose is finite. Isn't that obvious? I had a guy in a student group that I taught. He met Christ personally, and he shared how God had entered his heart, and he says, I can't believe my life has just been turned inside out. I'm a completely new person. He left the Bible study that night. 5 hours later, he was dead. Just like that. And thank God he had made that decision. No one expected that, I can tell you. It was instant. It was definite. And boy, if he had put his decision off, that would have been the same thing as the door to the ark closing. Once that door closed, that was it. Freedom had run its course, and now the decision was made. 2 Peter chapter 2, 5 says that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. And so as people would gather out by the ark, apparently sometimes Noah would put his work down and come out and explain to the people, the reason we're doing this is God has decreed such and so and so and so. And you can just hear, you know, this would have really brought some derision down then. Oh, yeah, we're pretty worried about that, all right. We're all going to flood out here. And, you know, I mean, it sounded pretty stupid. Up until the day that the door to the ark was closed. Now it didn't seem stupid anymore. You know, we talk about some pretty stupid things, too. We talk that Jesus Christ is going to come back.
And some people think, oh yeah, like heck, that'll be the day. You know, maybe there were some people watching Noah build, and maybe some of them thought to themselves, you know, I think maybe I will just get on with Noah, because maybe this guy's had this vision that he claims, and they sure seem convinced. I wonder about the world we're in sometimes, why God hasn't done something already. And I'm thinking maybe I'm going to get on and throw in with these guys. And there would have been the opportunity to do that, but you know, I'm going to put it off. I'll do it when I feel right about it. I don't quite feel it yet. In the end, nobody did. Nobody did. And so, you know, it's the case where the truth is heard, opportunity is given, no one's taken, no one's interested. And that's very applicable to us because it's a spiritual principle. That you have the freedom to choose here tonight, but you do not have the freedom not to choose. That's one thing that we've not been given. You can walk out of here tonight, you've made a choice already. You've decided either I will accept the gift of salvation that Christ is offering, or I'm going to put it off, I'm going to not accept it. Matthew 12:30. Jesus said, you either gather with me or you scatter without me. He says, you've got to be for or against me. You've got to make that choice. You've got to decide where you stand with God. The failure to come forward and to actively receive what he's offering us is a choice. That's a choice. It's a decision. And at a certain point in time, maybe not tonight, maybe 5 years from now, you would come back and think about it again and change your mind, and all will go well. There's really no guarantee that that's going to happen. Our choice is limited and finite. We don't know what the limit is, though. Jesus said in Matthew 24, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and swept them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And Christ gave this as a warning so that people would not get caught. And he says, therefore be in readiness, for you do not know what hour and day the Son of Man is coming. It's time to get ready for the coming of Jesus Christ. John 5:24, Jesus puts the offer as strictly as it can be. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. And he does not come into judgment, but has passed out of death and into life. This water that signified judgment sweeping people away. Don't even come in. Yes, there is a judgment day. That's true. But you can bypass that and go directly to eternal life if you'll let Jesus take your judgment upon himself at the cross, ask to be included in his sacrifice, and he'll do it. Avoid the judgment of God. It's real. Doesn't matter what we say about it. We can hurl invectives and say, well, I God like that, so on and so forth. None of that matters. He's still going to judge. And we need to get out from under his judgment and partake of the gift that he's offered us in love. That's the real meaning of the flood. Well, next week we want to study Nimrod the Mighty Hunter, which is another remarkable story in the Old Testament account there, so I hope you come out with us and study that passage. Okay, we're out of time. Why don't we turn to the Lord? Heavenly Father, this is a super challenging passage. You know, we've got all of our questions. We wonder whether it's a local flood. We wonder whether it's a universal flood. What we know is that in this case, you found it necessary to judge. Lord, it's very upsetting to us. As we know that even you are upset by your need to judge. And you've told us in the Word that you take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. You've told us that entering judgment is to enter your strange work, something that is essentially alien to your desires. And yet, you are a moral God, a righteous God, and a God of justice. So, Lord, we just realize we have to accept this and come to terms with it. We thank you more than anything that you've taken your own judgment on yourself in the person of Christ.
that you've made it possible for us to escape judgment free of charge and without any works on our part. And that certainly is a mark of your other attribute of love. It must be an incredible position for you to be in, Lord, where you love people and yet you're also God of justice. It's a real bind. And frankly, the offer that you've made to us of salvation free of charge is probably better than anything we could have expected. Truthfully, God, I think in our hearts we all know that we deserve to be judged. Every one of us is guilty of sin and has fallen short of your standard. And I know, Lord, as a non-Christian and still as a Christian, I had the conviction clearly if a hell existed, I knew I would be there. And yet, Lord, what we found is new life freely given, the possibility of having you in our hearts, a dynamic personal relationship there. It's pretty cool. This was a bad episode that we studied tonight. And we know, Lord, that some more bad stuff is coming up. The things that are going to happen on this earth, the things that you've predicted in your word, the return to the one worldism, to the union of the human race, something that hasn't existed since the time of Genesis, and which always seems to end up in sort of unmitigated evil. We're not looking forward to that, God. And yet we realize it may be just around the corner. As we study these things and we get into some of the predictions in the Bible next week, Lord, we pray that it will just serve the purpose of quickening or strengthening the urgency of our own spiritual walk and also the gratitude that we feel as we realize that we've been able to escape judgment through the death of Christ. We thank you for that in Christ's name. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.